From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Stephen Sefton, reporting live from Nicaragua.
Hi, Don. Thanks again for having me on your program. So there was a lot happening over the weekend. Last weekend, there were elections in Peru, Ecuador, Bolivia. There's quite a bit to say about the results from those elections. Perhaps before we do start looking at those results, it might be helpful to look again at the regional context and one of the things that's happening in that regional context that most affects the United States directly, namely migration from the Northern Triangle countries of Central America, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. What that phenomenon embodies is very, very relevant to what's happening in the rest of the region, in South America, and in those countries where they had elections over the weekend. And of course, that has to do with the historic imposition by the United States of its Monroe Doctrine and the idea of manifest destiny and the suggestion that the United States has the divine right to impose its wishes and its way of doing things, its political model, its economic model on Latin America and the Caribbean. And what that reflects is a U.S. inability now in the current context, especially with the emergence of a multipolar world in which countries like China and other Asian countries are rivaling U.S. economic power, and Russia is rivaling U.S. military power, and Iran is also both an economic and a military power, that the United States is reluctant to challenge directly because Iran is now engaged in what looks like a strategic relationship for the next 25, 30 years with China, and is also developing a strong strategic relationship with Russia. But despite that wider global reality, in terms of Latin America and the Caribbean region, the United States persists in refusing to engage the sovereign nations of the region as equals, and instead prioritizes extremely destructive policies aimed at dominating the region. And the end result of that kind of destructive domination, one can see very clearly in Haiti and very clearly in Honduras, which are essentially countries that are failed states. And one can also see that destructive domination promoted by the United States, embodied in its penchant for imposing sanctions, illegal coercive unilateral measures, against countries that don't do what the United States wants. And so last week we were looking at how, within the overall regional context, the United States is compensating its global inability to compete with China economically by, at the regional level of Latin America and the Caribbean, extending its military presence, extending military cooperation agreements and exercises, imposing lawfare, working closely with local elites to subvert due process via illegitimate use of the judicial and criminal justice system in the different countries of the region, and also by means of its dominant financial control of the region's financial system. And in terms of the migration from Central America, the results of that refusal to engage the region's sovereign nations as equals is coming home to affect the United States, because the United States is unwilling, not unable, but unwilling to assimilate tens of thousands of Central American migrants every month who arrive at the United States' southern borders seeking entry to the country, not necessarily because they're greatly enamored of the American dream, but because they're driven out of their own countries out of desperation, partly as a result of the economic situation, which is a direct result of U.S. policies over the last 50, 60 years, partly as a result of the prevalence of organized crime, which also is a direct result of United States policy over the last 30, 40, 50 years. And so what that Central American migration phenomenon is exposing is the complete falsity of the self-image and the image that the United States likes to project of itself as a country committed to humanitarian values, as a country that's a forthright defender of fundamental human rights. And you can see all that exposed for the sham that it is by the reality of what's happening at the United States southern border in its treatment of migrants from Central America traveling to the United States across Mexico. And in response to that, the United States have come up with a $4 billion investment plan in the three countries from which the overwhelming majority of the migrants are leaving from. And at the same time, they're encouraging militarization of the frontiers, Mexico, Guatemala, which is much more in line with their historic policies in the region. Now, the UN Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, together with the Mexican government led by President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, they recently came up with a $30 billion plan, which they call a Comprehensive Investment and Infrastructure Plan, which they hope will be able to address effectively the causes of migration from Central America's Northern Triangle. But although that sounds like a lot of money, it's a plan that's aimed over the next 5, 6, 7 years. And even that sum is, in my opinion, too little too late to address the deep-seated social trauma, the entrenched economic inequality, and the effects of accelerating climate change in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And if you compare what's happened in those countries over the last 10, 15 years with what's happened in Nicaragua over the last 10, 15 years, Nicaragua's example shows a clear route map, if you like, for how to successfully avoid the kind of distress-driven migration that has so badly affected its northern neighbours. But the US response to that reality has been to impose sanctions on Nicaragua. And so, in effect, what you have in relation to the issue of migration from Central America to the United States is yet another example of the way the kind of dead hand of US intervention chokes off the practical, realistic, and successful options that are available for a better life for the impoverished majorities of the countries of the region. In this case, countries like El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. What they're doing to Central America in the Northern Triangle is what they've done to Haiti, and the end result will be the same. And the reason I think that's important before we start talking about the results of the elections in Ecuador, Peru, and Bolivia is because it's that very same dynamic that's at work in countries across the region with impoverished majorities that are desperate for social and economic stability. And in particular, over the last 5 years, the United States has worked with local elites either to co-opt malleable leaders, like, for example, Lenin Moreno in Ecuador, probably the most notorious example. But also they set out to deliberately eliminate from electoral politics people like Ignacio Lula da Silva, the former president of Brazil, who was barred by a corrupt judicial process from participating in the last elections in Brazil. And going back to Ecuador, and they've done the same in the case of Rafael Correa, who has charges pending against him, completely phony charges alleging corruption, promoted by an oligarchy that's one of the most corrupt in the whole of South America. And one of the other things that we can see that the United States has become very adept at in the region has been the way it's able to promote division among the political movements that are usually a majority in the different countries concerned, and to prevent those political movements of diverse ideologies from uniting so as to defeat electorally the right-wing power blocs that in most of the countries have something between 25 and 35% solid support. You can see across the region that in most of the countries that we talk about on this program, there's a basic majority in favor of progressive political movements, progressive political policies, even radical or revolutionary political policies, between anything from 35 to 45%. And so you've got a floating vote of anything from 20 to 35 or 40% that is up for grabs. And it's that section of political opinion, public opinion, electoral opinion in the countries that we discuss that is the key battleground for electoral success. And you can see that. You can see that reality in different ways in the electoral processes that have taken place in Ecuador, Peru, and Bolivia. We had the final results of the departmental elections in Bolivia last Sunday. We had the second round results of the presidential elections in Ecuador and Peru. So in Ecuador, the second round runoff was a political triumph for the extreme right-wing candidate, neoliberal candidate Guillermo Lasso, who won with something over 53% of the vote, against 47%+ for the progressive candidate associated with former President Rafael Correa, Andrés Arauz. A lot of people were taken by surprise by that because the opinion polls over the last 4 or 5 weeks had suggested that Andres Arauz would win, perhaps not by a big margin, but he was the favourite to win. Now, I always had misgivings about that, right from the result of the first round vote, which Andres Arauz won with something like 32%, and then the second place candidate, Guillermo Lasso, won 19%. But then when you looked at all the other candidates that took part in the vote, they all made, almost all of them, made very clear that they intended, all the best placed candidates, made very clear that they were going to offer their support to Guillermo Lasso. Yacoub Pérez, who almost tied with Lasso for second place in the first round. He was the political candidate for the Pachakutik Indigenous People's Political Party, which is the political arm of Ecuador's national coordinating body for indigenous peoples, CONAIE. He disputed the first round results unsuccessfully, demanding a recount. And then what his tactic was, subsequent to his failure to displace Guillermo Lasso as the candidate going into the electoral runoff, he set out to promote a campaign for a null vote, encouraging people, indigenous people. Ecuador's indigenous population is almost 2 million that are eligible to vote out of a population eligible to vote in Ecuador of 11 million. So if something close to 2 million people decide that they're going to make what they call a null vote, that's going to have a huge effect on the population that's going to be able to vote for the two candidates in the runoff. And sure enough, around 16% of voters issued a null vote. And there's no doubt at all that had a very serious effect on the final outcome. But the other factors that affected the vote were that Andres Arauz had a huge disadvantage because for this electoral campaign, he had to, in effect, organise a completely new party, setting up a new party structure with a new electoral structure for his party in a very short period of time. And the effects of that on the outcome are now all too clear. Whereas Guillermo Lasso, who's been a candidate in the previous two presidential elections, losing first to Rafael Correa and then subsequently losing to Lenin Moreno in the last presidential election, he already had a very finely honed and well-prepared electoral machine. And that gave him a huge material advantage over Andres Arauz. And although Yacoub Pérez was formally calling for a null vote, any people who tended to sympathise with his brand of progressive politics, and also people who tended to sympathise with another pseudo-left candidate, a guy called Javier Hervas, both Pérez and Hervas made very clear that they were opposed to Andres Arauz. So their political sympathisers will have voted for Lasso, even though nominally their ideology is supposedly left-wing. And in addition to that, of course, you had the standard wall-to-wall media coverage from the country's main national media, both print media, radio and TV media, attacking Andres Arauz 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So in fact, it's really no surprise at all that Andres Arauz lost this presidential election, despite his political party being the biggest party in the country, the biggest single party in the country, and having the most number of deputies in the country's National Assembly. So what can we expect from a Lasso presidency? Well, he signalled very clearly that even before he gets into office, he's going to be working towards negotiating a free trade agreement with the United States. He's already talking about the privatisation of public assets. And in fact, Lenin Moreno's government, very much under the influence of the country's oligarchy, figures like Guillermo Lasso and others, is already working to privatise the country's central bank. Lasso's talking about opening up Ecuador to oil and gas investment. He's talking about abolishing a very important component of the constitutional reforms that took place in Ecuador following the first presidential election won by Rafael Correa back before 2010. And that body is essentially a kind of auditing body, or perhaps a better word is an oversight body, giving Ecuador's citizens the power to call Ecuador's government and institutions to account. And Lasso's talking about abolishing that. And he's also talking about doing things like eliminating an oversight body that was set up under the government of Rafael Correa to regulate private universities. What you've got in Lasso is the embodiment of the most extreme neoliberal right-wing ideology. And that takes us back to what I was saying earlier about how the end result of US intervention in the area is extremely destructive, creating economies and societies that are incapable of functioning for the benefit of their country's majority, especially the impoverished majority, as we can see in countries like Haiti and Honduras. And that's the direction in which Guillermo Lasso as president is going to take Ecuador. And of course, there'll be increased military cooperation with the United States. They might even reopen the base at Manta from which they were expelled by Rafael Correa. They already have a base in the Galapagos that they negotiated with Lenin Moreno. And in broader foreign policy terms, it means that there's going to be no change in Ecuador's stance vis-a-vis regional integration. Guillermo Lasso is going to prioritize the right-wing neoliberal agenda of Colombia, Chile, Peru, Ecuador itself. And diplomatically, Ecuador is likely to maintain an extremely aggressive position against Venezuela. And one shouldn't underestimate the extent to which the demonization of Venezuela by regional media in countries like Ecuador and Peru has a very serious effect on candidates who pitch themselves as being progressive, especially candidates that are associated in any way with the policies of leaders like Rafael Correa, who promoted integration via the model of the Bolivarian Alliance for the Americas. Ecuador used to be a member of ALBA, as it's called, and now practically all the main ALBA countries, Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela, are under attack via sanctions from the United States government. And of course, accompanying the sanctions is a constant, permanent, extremely virulent psychological warfare campaign, demonizing all the countries of the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas, but in particular Venezuela. And so whereas I wasn't really surprised, but I was very disappointed, it's a very disappointing result for Ecuador. But I don't think one should really have been surprised by it. But I was extremely surprised by the election result, the first round election results in Peru, which also belied the opinion polls in the run-up to that election. And there the leading candidates after that first round vote, which included something over 15 candidates, I think the total number of electoral candidates was something like 18 or more. But according to the opinion polls, only 5 or 6 of those candidates had a realistic chance of getting into the second round. But none of the opinion polls gave the winner, this guy Pedro Castillo, even the slim hope of making the runoff ballot. And in fact, he won. He won the first round with something like 19% of the vote. And the person going into the second round with him is the extreme right-winger Keiko Fujimori, the daughter of Alberto Fujimori, the former dictator in Peru. And whereas prior to this election, I thought that this presidential election in Peru was unlikely to resolve Peru's deep-seated problems, in some ways very similar to the problems of the Northern Triangle countries in Central America. For example, in Guatemala, there's a strong indigenous population like there is in Peru. I thought that the election would result in another standoff between centrist-style parties that really don't have any radical answers or fundamental answers or answers that even begin to measure up to the problems facing Peru's society and economy, long-standing inequality, ingrained racism against indigenous peoples, extraordinary levels of corruption that is just routine, and almost permanent political stalemate. But in fact, what's happened now is that Pedro Castillo is a candidate who, by Peruvian standards, is radical. One good way to get an idea of how radical he is and how determined he is, too, and how principled he is the fact that whereas the kind of centre-left candidate Veronica Mendoza, when pressed on Venezuela, ends up conceding that, yes, Venezuela is a dictatorship and that, yes, Nicolas Maduro is a tyrant, Pedro Castillo's response when being pressed very strongly by local media to say what his position is on Venezuela and whether he thinks that Venezuela is a dictatorship, his position, his answer has been, no, Venezuela's not a dictatorship because they have elections and there's a political opposition, which is an extremely common sense and truthful answer. But in the political context of the Andean countries like Ecuador, Colombia, Peru, that kind of political position is kind of poison. And conventional candidates avoid saying anything nice about Venezuela like the plague. But Castillo is somebody he's a teacher's leader. He's somebody who is involved in a teacher's strike in 2017 that lasted for over 2 months. His campaign was based on meeting people face to face and mobilizing his base among approves teachers in his favour, and whereas teachers in other countries in the region might not be especially highly regarded, in Peru teachers are generally quite highly regarded by the communities where they work. And so despite not having significant levels of funding at all, Pedro Castillo was still able to pull off this very surprising result. And the fundamental thing that set Pedro Castillo apart from most of the other candidates was that he openly and strongly advocated the government should take a more active and a more central role in promoting and directing the economy, which is something diametrically opposed to the kind of extreme neoliberal policies promoted by now president-elect Guillermo Lasso in Ecuador. So now the two candidates, Pedro Castillo and Keiko Fujimori, have until early May. I think their runoff is on May 7th. And while it's certainly possible that Pedro Castillo may be able to cause an upset and win against Keiko Fujimori, just like Andrés Arauz in Ecuador, he's going to be up against all the machinery of Peru's political establishment, who have whatever misgivings they may have about Keiko Fujimori being the daughter of the former dictator Alberto Fujimori and about her own well-established corrupt practices. The Peruvian elite, the Peruvian oligarchy, are certainly definitely going to be supporting Keiko Fujimori, with whom they're going to feel much more comfortable than a maverick radical outsider like Pedro Castillo. And let's hope I'm wrong about that. Let's hope that Pedro Castillo is indeed able to pull off what would be a stunning upset. And then moving to Bolivia, and some people may have been surprised as well by the results in Bolivia. Perhaps I should explain that last Sunday, Bolivia held runoff elections in four departments where the first round votes were not conclusive. And under Bolivia's electoral rules, the elections in those four departments had to go to a runoff. And those four departments are Tarija, Chuquisaca, Pando, and La Paz itself. And Evo Morales, following the elections on Sunday, has conceded that the MAS party lost those four departments in which they were running. And the most disappointing, perhaps, from the MAS party's point of view, was losing in the department of La Paz, which includes the capital and the very important indigenous stronghold in El Alto, just outside La Paz. Probably the main factor from the point of view of the MAS party as a party, explaining why they didn't do any better in those departmental elections, despite having won the presidential elections last year by a huge margin, an unprecedented margin. One of the reasons that they didn't do so well at this departmental level in the elections last Sunday was that the hiatus of the usurper government that was installed by the military coup of October 2019. That hiatus created a lot of disruption and division among the MAS party supporters. And this goes back to, again, what I was saying right at the beginning about the way the United States is able to intervene in the region and work in a very insidious way, promoting ideological division. In Ecuador, you could see that absolutely clearly in the case of Yaku Pérez and the way he was advocating what essentially in United States or European terms, I suppose, are identity politics. And perhaps that's true also in the case of Bolivia, where all through the period of the usurper regime installed by the military coup, the MAS party was persecuted. Its activists were often physically attacked, imprisoned. And while in the legislature, they managed to coexist with the usurper regime under Jeanine Añez in that legislature, although MAS deputies had the majority, what seems to have happened is that the imposition of the coup regime fermented divisions, underlying divisions in the MAS party that have now become explicit in these departmental elections. But it may make sense to look at the results of those departmental elections last Sunday in an optimistic way, because although to some extent they may complicate implementation of the government's domestic agenda, in the medium and long term, given the political astuteness of the MAS party leadership and their ability to demonstrate the integrity and the validity of their progressive agenda, and especially their defence of indigenous people, the most probable outcome is that they'll rise to the challenge presented by the divisions that have surfaced over the last 15 months or so, 18 months or so, and end up strengthening the party prior to future elections. Other points worth noting from events over the last week or so are that in Brazil, it's still not clear that Lula will will not end up facing the charges which were recently annulled against him, because that Supreme Court decision apparently is subject to review, and it may well be the case, if there's a negative result from Lula's point of view, that the charges that were originally made against him could possibly be reinstated, and he'll have to face the whole process all over again, albeit in a different jurisdiction. Stay in Brazil. There's also a suggestion that there may be an attempt in the legislature to displace Jair Bolsonaro, the president, in much the same way that Dilma Rousseff was displaced from the presidency in 2016. But for the moment, it looks as though that process is not going to progress, and it remains to be seen what will happen. Essentially, what you're looking at is the Brazilian elite, the Brazilian oligarchy, arguing amongst themselves and with the country's military about what to do with Bolsonaro, who's in many ways become a lame duck president as a result of his hopeless mishandling both of Brazil's economy, but also more especially his mishandling of the outbreak of COVID-19 in Brazil, where over 300,000 deaths have been attributed to that disease. In relation to Colombia and Venezuela, the armed standoff along the Venezuelan border, where the Department of Apure in Venezuela borders Colombia, that armed standoff is continuing. Not very much has changed since we talked about that last week. They're continuing skirmishes between armed groups of organized crime in the region, supported apparently by the Colombian authorities. The Venezuelan army is very active in the region, and there was a report today that a total of 1,000 Venezuelan militia will be mobilized to the region to support the army combating these paramilitary groups of organized crime. In Colombia itself, the continuing spate of massacres, there have been over 26, 27 so far this year, that continues. The continuing murders of social leaders, indigenous people's leaders, and former FARC fighters who signed up to the peace agreement. That disgraceful campaign of murders continues in Colombia, and with next to no response from the government, which is hardly surprising since Iván Duque, the president, is so closely associated with the paramilitary groups that are mainly responsible for the violence. Perhaps if we're able to talk next week, we can have a closer look at that phenomenon in Colombia and compare it to what's going on in the rest of the region, and look at the response from the Western human rights industry and compare that response with Western human rights organizations' repeated condemnation of Venezuela, which has nothing like the levels of violence, the incredible levels of violence that prevail in Colombia.
That's Stephen Sefton coming to us from Nicaragua, reporting on news and events in Latin America and the Caribbean. Stephen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me on your program.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.